I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is a special edition of Radio Boston. Imagine, it's 1862, or thereabouts, and Emily Dickinson is sitting in her Amherst home, perhaps by the window, perhaps bathed in a pale winter light. She picks up her pen and writes. It sifts from leaden sieves. It powders all the wood. It fills with alabaster wool the wrinkles of the road. It makes an even face of mountain and of plain, unbroken forehead from the east unto the east again. It reaches to the fence. It wraps it rail by rail till it is lost in fleeces. It deals celestial veil to stump and stack and stem a summer's empty room, acres of joints where harvests were, recordless but for them. It ruffles wrists of posts as ankles of a queen, then stills its artisans like ghosts, denying they have been. Well, such is the timeless power of a New England winter. We don our boots and coats, or hunker down, and in that gruff but collective act of shared suffering in darkness and in cold, we see the beauty of winter. Or at least, that's how I see it. I love New England winters. So this hour, we're going to listen back to some of our favorite conversations about the season, from how lovely it can be to how very loathsome. We're going to start with a conversation we recently had with New Englander Will Dowd. He's a poet, and in the spirit of Dickinson and even Henry David Thoreau's Walden, Dowd kept a journal of a full year of his observations about the weather. The result is his debut collection of essays titled Areas of Fog. And we started with the question, why would someone who isn't a scientist or meteorologist keep track of the weather for an entire year?
I did it because I was struck with writer's block. I had tons of creative energy, but I didn't have a subject, and I was just stalled for a really long time. And so what I did is one day I had this idea that I would resort to our regional habit that we have of, when you have nothing to talk about, talking about the weather.
Or complaining about the weather.
Mostly complaining. And so I used the weather as an opening to a series of essays which I kept every week for an entire year.
Well, I would love if you could read a little bit of the fruits of all that labor. And just how about this part right here from your overture?
Sure. This is I wrote this on January 1st. So it was New Year's Day. And this is how it opens. All the weathermen of New England go mad eventually. After a few decades spent attempting to predict the unpredictable, they succumb to a kind of meteorological nihilism and wander out of the studio mid-broadcast, muttering to themselves, and can be seen a week later selling wilted roses on the side of the highway. It's not the seasonal anarchy, all those balmy Christmases and washed-out Junes, but rather the perverse changeability of our daily weather, the adolescent moodiness of our sun and sky, that finally unravels the sweater of their sanity. In the spring, I have counted 136 different kinds of weather inside of 4 and 20 hours, Mark Twain, a Hartford resident for 17 years, once quipped. Yet while they may be doomed to fail, we don't mock our weathermen, even though we see them for what they are, oracles draped in sheep entrails. We don't change the channel. We listen politely to their forecast, and then we talk about it.
That's Will Dowd reading an excerpt of his collection of essays called Areas of Fog. Yeah, we talk about it a lot.
We do. You know, when I started this, it was a conceit. But actually, as I went along, I discovered that I think all our talk about the weather actually has a deeper meaning. I think it's a great uniter. It doesn't matter who you are, whether you're rich or poor or old or young. If you're walking through slush, your socks are getting wet.
Yeah. I mean, weather is a great uniter. It's a great equalizer, especially in a place like New England, whose weather is so mercurial. So let me ask you, I mean, New England still has a huge variety of weather on any particular day in any part of the region. Where in New England were you?
Yes. So I grew up on the South Shore. I moved away for a while and then moved back. Perhaps that was contributing to my writer's block, being back in my hometown. We all know what that experience is like. And I'd grown up in New England, taking our fickle weather for granted, And then once I was separated from it and came back, I realized just how sort of strange it is that all the climates of the world seem to come to us and converge on our little corner.
Yeah. I mean, so just for example, I was thinking of on a day that you could be basking under the sun on the South Shore, if you're at the top of Mount Washington in New Hampshire, you could be getting your face blown off by the wind practically.
Absolutely.
But I'd like to just read a little bit from one of your in a January entry that you made, because I think this will really, really hit home for so many people listening. You write that it's the existential question that all New Englanders ask themselves in late January. We stand at or lie beneath a sunny window, attempting to bask in secondhand warm, and we ask ourselves the question, why is winter happening to me? Why do I live here voluntarily? I feel like we've come through a couple winters like that where that is exactly what everyone was thinking.
Yes, exactly. I mean, famously, J.D. Salinger said, "Poets take the weather so personally." I think we're all poets in New England. We really treat it as if it's a sentient being, as if it has it's a sort of judgment on us. And I think that does come from our history, our literary history, and even the Puritan history that we have in this region, because they really saw the weather as God's hand. And God, you know, blessing or passing judgment on us. And I think we still subconsciously feel that every time, you know, a bride prays for clear skies on her the day of her outdoor wedding, you know, I think we're tapping into that.
You have in a February entry, it's as if certain features of New England weather are copyrighted by certain writers. Dickinson has a trademark on that slant of afternoon light. Frost owns ice-bowed boughs.
Try saying that 20 times fast.
Or even once.
Yes.
And Nabokov has an incontestable claim on melting icicles. Such a good point. Were there other artists, writers, or I'll throw it even further open, painters that inspired you?
Absolutely. So every essay pretty much brings in a historical figure. Andrew Wyeth makes an appearance pretty early because I say when it snows outside, every window becomes the frame to an Andrew Wyeth painting in New England. And that's what inhabits my brain because I was a huge reader, a huge consumer of art. I love this stuff. And I think that weather in particular for New England writers and artists has just been such a great resource for metaphor and material because it's something we all have access to and it's a kind of common language where we can use to ask big questions.
Yeah. You know, you're so right. Once you sort of open your mind to the primacy of weather in New England art and literature, it's hard to stop thinking about it because I was thinking all of a sudden a horse shaking its snowy mane in a Frost poem.
Right.
Or the late summer sun of a Hopper painting from the Cape.
Absolutely.
It just fills your mind. Well, when you get to summer in the essays, you write, "All winter, you looked forward to summer. You anticipated the return of the sun with religious fervor, convinced that ecstasy and sunlight are the self-same. But here you are, barefoot on a green lawn in June, realizing the difficult truth that happiness is not, in fact, photosynthetic." Oh, it's beautifully written. Although I suppose in the winter, one might take objection to that and say yes, it's maybe photosynthetic.
Right.
But where were you when you wrote that?
Oh, I think everybody has this experience where you go through this horrible, monotonous Groundhog's Day of a winter, and you think, once the weather is nice, I'm not going to have a care in the world. But then when that happens, all your troubles are still follow you.
The act of having to think about and write about the weather, it had to force you to be more tuned in with the environment, your surroundings, what was happening than I would guess most of us are on a daily basis. Did it make you also observe things about New England that you hadn't or hadn't thought about before?
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I love this story about Emily Dickinson, that when she was younger, her father, who was a really imposing guy, taught her how to tell time with a clock, and she didn't get it, but she was too afraid to say that because her father was a little bit scary, and so she kept the secret to herself that she couldn't read a clock. And so until she was a in her late teens, she had to tell time using sunlight, you know, almost like a sundial method. And I think her poetry is filled with that kind of imagery. And it felt the same way for me. Once you really tune yourself into the weather and to the, you know, the way the shadows are cast and the way the sunlight feels and acts, it's like you're in a different, you're a little bit tuned into a different time and a different way of measuring the world. But that's, you know, this is the job description of a poet. We're like weather vanes, right? You need to be sensitive to these unseen forces.
Poet Will Dowd joined us just last month to talk about his debut collection of essays titled Areas of Fog. Stay with us. There's more ahead in this special celebration of winter. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're cozying up, embracing the darkness, and focusing on this most New England of seasons, winter. And that, of course, means that we must talk about the epic winter of 2015, the snowiest in Boston history. More than 100 inches of the white stuff fell, bringing the region to an awful standstill, crippling the MBTA and testing the human limits of snow shoveling. I know you still remember it. A tough year that revealed how unprepared we still are for the extremes nature can throw at us. But, you know, I know that there were a lot of flinty New Englanders out there who rolled their eyes and said, "Quit your complaining." And they have a point. Hard for all of us puffy down jacket wearing central heat loving gas powered snowblower pushing city folk to believe. But, you know, winter in New England did exist before synthetic ice melt. Basically, for centuries, the native peoples of New England and the settlers who came much later had to live through winters that were long, dark, and hard. So how did they do it? For answers, we turn to Darius Coombs. He's associate director of the Wampanoag Indigenous Program at Plymouth Plantation and a member of the Wampanoag Tribe. We also spoke with Robert Allison. He's a professor of history and was then the chair of Suffolk University's History Department. Darius started by telling us what it was like at home for the native people of Massachusetts during winter in the early 16th and 17th centuries.
Well, we had houses like people have houses today. Normally the roofing for our houses was on tree bark, and the types of bark you would have seen being used would have been a lot of elm and chestnut bark. Hmm. And the frames for these houses were made out of, usually out of cedar themselves. You want to use cedar because it takes probably 15, 20 years to rot in the ground. But the way you made the houses was pretty much in a round shape. If you took an egg, cut it in half, and put it onto a table, that's the shape of a house we would have.
So dome-shaped, essentially.
A dome-shaped house, yes. So I've been inside these houses here at the museum, actually in blizzard conditions, and in hurricane conditions, and the winds go right around them. Mm. It's very aerodynamic.
Yeah.
And if you've been in one of our houses here at the museum, the houses will easily get to be 70, 80 degrees with no problem.
Wow. In the depths of winter.
Oh, yeah, in the depth of winter.
Wow. And I've been reading that the native peoples, for example, use some pretty smart tricks to keep warm while being outside.
We have recordings of Europeans seeing native people outside during the winter, sometimes with no top on, the men. But what the men would have on their bodies would have been a lot of black bear fat, a lot of goose fat. What that does is repel the moisture, keeps the cold out and the warm in. Hmm. For us as a people, we spent most of our life outside. And as you're outside more and more, your body will adjust to a certain degree to the weather. Now, that's not to say we didn't wear fur tops, because we did. We had fur tops, but not like how people wear fur coats today. You know, normally you wear the hairs going against your body. And by wearing the hairs against your body, that keeps your body a lot warmer than wearing the hairs out.
Yeah. And I wonder, I mean, from records and oral histories that you have, I mean, were the expectations of members of the Wampanoag Nation at the time, I mean, were basically that they were going to move in concert with the rhythms of nature, or that they didn't need to make very many changes because you know the way that society was set up, as you were saying, with these very well designed houses, it didn't matter what the season was.
No, you normally would have a summer place and a winter place. come during the spring and summer months, you would come out near the waterways, come out near the ocean, and that's when you do a lot of your planting and fishing. But once you're at harvest time, come and go, you dry those vegetables out and you would bring them with you into your winter community. You would either bring them with you, but also store a lot in the ground so you have something to eat in the spring.
Mm.
But when you went inland, inland does not have to be far during the fall and winter. Inland might be a mile, might be 5 miles inland. What you're looking for is a large settlement of woods or a valley to move into. The idea for moving away from the coast is to get away from that wind chill factor.
Right, right.
You know?
Well, Bob Allison, your chair of history at Suffolk University, I'm looking at a diary entry that Samuel Sewall wrote in 1680, so well after the pilgrims arrived, but he wrote, Charles River frozen over. Courageous south wind breaks the ice between Boston and Dorchester Neck. Hath been a very severe winter for snow and a constant continuance of cold weather, such as most affirm hath not been for many years. I'm just wondering, when the settlers or the pilgrims, for example, first arrived here, you know, they encountered the Wampanoag Nation, who obviously were well-suited and knew how to live through winters. How did they first handle it?
I was just thinking, my first visit to Plymouth Plantation was on a bitterly cold day in December, I think. The wind was whipping off of Plymouth Bay, and the houses were drafty and cold. You were shivering inside the houses. And then we walked to the Wampanoag village, and it was beautiful inside these houses because the native people knew how to live in this environment. And the Europeans came and tried to import a technological standard that they had that really didn't suit this environment. So they shivered a lot. They had cold, drafty houses with chimneys that really sucked all of the air out. And so the native people had figured this out. It took the English a long time to make the environment adapt to them, which is what they wanted to do.
Okay, so that's an interesting distinction, right? Rather than adapting to the environment and adopting the technology that was right there with the Wampanoag, they were bent on making nature adapt to them.
Yes, they were, because they had an understanding of nature, and they were supposed to dominate nature. It was, you know, a part of their mission here in the wilderness to make this adapt. So they also sought wooded places so that they could get firewood, and that's one reason that New England becomes deforested relatively quickly, is because of the need for firewood in these houses. And, you know, we may think, boy, what terrible people, they did this. Well, if we tried to live without a fuel source, we would probably do much the same thing.
Right.
So, yeah, and they did experience much colder winters here than they had in Europe, and much more snow, also hotter summers. So the climate here was different from the European climate.
Right, and I mean, much colder in a way that's almost impossible for us to imagine, since most of us luckily have heat indoors
right.
in this day and age. I mean, I'm looking at an 1857 a piece of writing from Thoreau, who's recalling the cold Friday of 1810.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story that his mother told him, and he writes about it in his journal. He says, Mother remembers the cold Friday very well. The people in the kitchen, Jack Garrison, Esther, and a Hardy girl, drew up close to the fire, which I presume was the only source of heat at the time. But the dishes which the Hardy girl was washing froze as fast as she washed them close to the fire.
It's amazing. You know, when Benjamin Franklin was christened in 1706, he was born in January, and the family bundled up the baby and took him across the street and into the Old South Meeting House, and they had to chip the ice from the baptismal font. Actually, it was solid ice, so they could christen him. As you know, they didn't have a heat source in the Old South, and during the British occupation of Boston in 1775 and 6, the British did cut down just about every tree in the town and also stripped the shingles and shutters and fences. But they needed a source of heat as well as a way to cook. Now, we think it was mean-spiritedness on their part. And if we tried to endure a winter without heat here, we would also become pretty desperate.
Yeah. Darius, can you describe to us for the Wampanoag, were social customs different in winter versus summer? I mean, you were saying earlier that people spend a lot of time outside regardless of the weather. But I'm wondering, when nature closes in and it gets dark for, you know, so many more hours in the day, were there different traditions?
Well, during the spring, summer, and fall months, you would see like strawberry festivals happening in June. That's the first fruit of the year. You would have green corn festivals, being immature corn, in the month of August. You had to see harvest festivals happening. But once it got a bit of cold during the winter, that's when you probably spend more time inside. And that's when you have the elders inside telling stories at night. The women, children might be making small baskets, playing with toys. Although the men will probably be outside quite a bit because that's the best time to hunt. That's when the furs are the thickest and the meat's the best. And even during the snow, actually, that's the best time to hunt for the animals, to track the animals.
Mm. And Bob, a similar question to you. I mean, were there just different social expectations when, you know, there aren't lights necessarily to turn on to make outside, you know, bright again?
Yeah, so you would go to bed earlier and because candles were relatively expensive. And a big danger for the English, of course, was that their livestock would be lost or overcome by the snow. And they needed to get in enough hay and have enough hay accessible. And the livestock getting lost in blizzards. We read a lot about this. And probably the most clever of these New England Yankees was Frederick Tudor in the early 19th century. He figured out a way actually to ship our ice to other places that didn't have it. So taking the ice from the frozen ponds of New England and sending it to Havana or to India. It's a present thing. And life did slow down in the winter because you've done the harvesting. And so women could still do the spinning, the weaving of the wool from the sheep. And so doing those kinds of indoor processes, spinning, weaving, you've already preserved all of the food, hopefully, mm-hmm. that you need. You've gotten the hay in. You've done all of these other chores that need to be done before winter sets in. And then again, in the long winter nights, you can have the telling of stories, the reading of the Bible, and the other things that during the summer months when you're working, you don't have as much time for.
Well, aside from the bitter, bitter cold that we've been talking about, it doesn't sound like too awful a way to think about coping with winter. So I guess my last quick question to both of you, Bob and Darius, is, you know, what one lesson do you think we should take from 17th and 18th century native peoples and the settlers about how to cope with this winter that we've been experiencing? Bob?
I think endure it. It will pass, and it will come again after what we hope will be a beautiful spring, summer, and fall.
And Darius?
I agree. Endure it. It happens. We're in New England. So spring will be here.
Maybe get together around the fire and tell each other some really good stories as
well. We should.
That was Robert Allison. He's a professor of history at Suffolk University. We also heard from Darius Coombs, associate director of the Wampanoag Indigenous Program at Plymouth Plantation and a member of the Wampanoag tribe. I spoke with them during the record-breaking winter of 2015. So that year reminded us how blizzards can be really big tests for modern governments, particularly for city mayors. And in the pages of The Atlantic, Yoni Applebaum argued that the idea of a modern American mayor was actually born in a blizzard back in 1888. It was known as the Great White Hurricane, a winter cataclysm so strong that it dumped some 40 inches of snow from New York to Boston, killing 400 people, sinking 200 ships, and paralyzing the Northeast for days. Applebaum joined Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks back in 2015 to explain how this historic storm changed American cities and the office of the mayor forever.
So the things that really set the blizzard of 1888 apart were first that it caught people unawares. People didn't know it was coming. They'd relied on telegraphs to relay news of the weather up the coast. And as the storm took down the telegraph cables, it took down their early warning system. So the blizzard came and dumped snow with massive winds. Drifts piled up as high as 52 feet in Brooklyn, if you can imagine that. Mm. And it stressed cities in a way that they hadn't been stressed before. Blizzards are a feature of the weather, but cities are a man-made construction. And as they got more complicated, they grew simultaneously more vulnerable to the extremes of weather.
So how were cities regarded back then, and how did this affect people's views, I guess, of the vulnerability of cities?
City residents then, and maybe now, were pretty smug. They looked out at the weather ravaging the Great Plains and felt warm and comfy in their urban dwellings. They had all of the conveniences and amenities of modern life. And they really believed that cities had made them, to some extent, invulnerable to nature. What they discovered and what shocked them in 1888 was that the same technologies which rendered them less vulnerable to nature on an ordinary day-to-day basis simultaneously rendered them far more vulnerable to cataclysmic natural disasters.
Yeah, and that's because the technologies that they depended on were were vulnerable, essentially, to these disasters, right?
Well, that's right. If you could call somebody on one of the newfangled telephones, you didn't have to walk out in the rain. If you could hop on a streetcar, you didn't have to trudge through the snow. On an ordinary day, that was great. But if all of your daily functions were built around this new modern technological infrastructure, and that infrastructure came crashing down, and it literally came crashing down in the blizzard, then people were stuck.
Okay, so bring us forward to mayors then. How did this blizzard of 1888 give birth to the modern mayor?
People started to ask that their mayors keep the infrastructure running, even in times of natural disaster, or at least to take precautions to restore it as quickly as possible after the storm had passed. When they realized how dependent they were on these technological contrivances, they started to demand that their municipal government do more to keep utilities and infrastructure up and running.
You write as well about sort of mayors taking the lead in major infrastructure improvements. I mean, for example, following this huge blizzard of 1888, you talk about the idea for subways is suddenly a really interesting idea for cities like New York and Boston.
Exactly. And they're off to the races after 1888, trying to get their systems going before Boston wants to go before New York. New York wants to get there first. It's an old rivalry. And they're also burying cables. They're putting in dozens of miles of pneumatic tubes to send the postal mail whisking beneath the city streets. In every way they can, they're trying to build systems that are invulnerable to the weather to replace the systems that had so catastrophically failed in 1888.
Well, these days, the city really works hard to address these storms. Yanni, I'm just curious. That sounds like a long way from the way early cities would deal with these kinds of problems, right?
Well, that's exactly right. Early cities would roll down the snow, pack it, and let people find their own way on sleds and sleighs. These days, we clear it to keep critical infrastructure accessible and to help cars and trucks and buses get up and down the streets. Mayors these days are proactive. They get out there ahead of the storm. They use it as an opportunity to demonstrate their competence to their constituents. And voters judge mayors based on their response to these storms. It's one of the rare opportunities that the electorate has to get a good sense of how well-oiled and functional the urban machinery really is.
Is that why blizzards can be such an important test for city government? I mean, in particularly for a mayor, because, I mean, often government kind of, to the average person, sort of takes place, the way governments move and make decisions happens behind closed doors. But suddenly you can see what government is doing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Blizzards are stress tests.
Yeah.
You put a system under a lot of pressure and a lot of strain, and you see how well it holds up. And it's a chance for voters to get a sense of whether or not a city can actually function and how good a job a mayor is doing on a day-to-day basis of managing the complex machinery of government.
So let me bring in a former mayor of Boston. Ray Flynn was the mayor of Boston from 1984 to 1993. He also served as U.S. ambassador to the Vatican under President Clinton. And Ambassador Flynn, welcome back to Radio Boston. It's really
nice
good
to
have you.
I was very interesting guest you just had on.
Well, he's still with us. That's Yanni Applebaum. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, and he oversees the politics section. But you've been listening to what he's been saying. Do you feel that the way you responded to blizzards and big storms was sort of among the big tests of your administration?
Yeah, I think it is because of the fact, as you pointed out, it's a way people can measure your effectiveness and how you did the job. You get rated not only by the press, but you also get rated by the public. I'm a person who walks quite a bit, maybe 5 miles a day. And I'm up and down Broadway. I walk into Dorchester and so forth. And so I speak to a lot of people, including this last few days. And they give you an assessment, a true assessment of, you know, how they think the mayor or how they think the city responded to the storm. And, you know, I've had this experience going back many, many years. I used to shovel people's sidewalks in my own South Boston neighborhood and the elderly and the housing projects and so forth. So, you know, I had a good sense of how this works.
Well, Ray Flynn, stand by because your successor, Mayor Marty Walsh, is on the line with us right now. Mayor Walsh, good to have you.
How are you? It's great to be on the phone with the mayor.
Well, we were talking also, Mr. Mayor, Yoni Applebaum here is with us. He's a senior editor of The Atlantic, and he's been writing about the importance of blizzards in terms of the way mayors respond to them. What's the biggest challenge, would you say?
It's very difficult to stay ahead of it and keeping the manpower available steady, and trying to keep down on the contractors, because we used a lot of our own people to clean the snow and to keep the cost down. So that's one challenge we have. And the other challenge is, we don't have enough plows and enough snow melters that we'd like to have, but we certainly have enough to handle the city.
Let me ask you both, since I have a former mayor and a current mayor on the line, this is going to sound so small and petty, but it always comes up, and it seems to really get people's passions going, and that is people reserving spaces with chairs. First of all, Ray Flynn, let me come to you. Was this an issue during your administration?
Not so much. I'll tell you why, because most of the people lived in this neighborhood, the neighborhood that I live in South Boston, and as well as many of the neighborhoods in Boston at the time.
Yeah.
A long-time residents there, and they had a lot of respect for each other. They grew up with their same families. And so there was a pride, there was a connection with the various people. Boston has changed in many respects the last 10, 15 years, a lot of condo conversion. So the city's changed. So, this stuff about having a chair, a toilet bowl, or a lounge chair in front of a place that they just shoveled out, I never heard of that. It would be unheard of. People would have more respect for their neighbor than who just shoveled out their parking
sure.
space than pulling their car in there. I never really saw that while I was mayor. And that's something that is relatively new, I believe.
What do you think, Mayor Walsh?
I think a lot of what the mayor said, back when I was growing up in Dorchester, and I grew up on a street with all three families, you'd shovel your space out. And you would, some streets you wouldn't have to reserve the space because it was just kind of unofficially known that the spot in front of your house was yours. The next street over from me, Howe Street, where I grew up on Taft, on Howe Street, people would leave, just literally drive around the block. If the spot was open in front of the McCurran's house, they wouldn't park there because that was a McCurran spot, and they'd find a spot. I think it's a culture thing. I think it's definitely an age thing. My generation and older, we're used to, we didn't have driveways. We shoveled out, and it would be our spot for a few days. And I think the media makes a big story out of this every single year, gins it up. And I ask people, if you park in somebody's spot, if you take the shovel spot out and you pull in there for a little bit, just when you leave, just put the thing back in. It's that easy. And it kind of almost like community parking.
All right, Mr. Mayor, thanks so much for joining us.
Right,
good luck to you.
All right, bye-bye.
Mayor Flynn, I want to stick with you. I remember that one of the things that you were famous for, among other things, was actually riding a snowplow during the storms. How did that happen? What was the story behind that?
Well, when I was a member of the city council, I remember hearing these stories of, ambulances trying to get up to streets in Roxbury. One case in particular, a man was trying to get rushed to the hospital, and they couldn't get him to the hospital. And that stayed with me all this time. And then I ran for mayor and won. And what I did was I had three or four snow plows going over to this one particular area in Roxbury, the black area of Roxbury. We shoveled out every single street. Really, it was an exceptional job that the workers did. And then I knocked at the door of some of the houses there, knocked at the doors of some of the houses, and I just said, look, we're over here doing the job. We just want to let you know that. And the people just absolutely loved that. Some of them had never seen a snowplow in their respective neighborhood. And then I said, wow, this thing really works. So as a result of that, I didn't have press conferences. I didn't tell the people what I was going to do before a storm. But I would be out in the neighborhoods on the snowplow. And, it was great not only for the morale of the workers, but it was also wonderful for the people in the neighborhoods of Boston because they saw, a hands-on approach, and they really understood how difficult it was, and I would explain to them what we had to do and so forth. As a result of that, it was one of the best innovative things I ever did, as simple as it sounds.
Yeah, well, Yoni, let me bring you back into this conversation because there's a modern mayor making great use of a blizzard to sort of communicate to folks what a mayor does.
Well, I think Mayor Flynn's exactly right. People can see that the snow is getting cleared. They can see the mayor standing up and being an effective leader for their town or their city. And people take tremendous pride in that. And so it's a chance for mayors to really reach out to voters, to connect with them, to show them that they care about the individual neighborhoods, the individual blocks, and to demonstrate that they can effectively deliver the kinds of services that their constituents desire.
Let me add one other little point here, if I will.
Sure.
There's a responsibility here on the city, of course, but there's also a responsibility on the part of the public. All right, I walked up to Broadway today in South Boston. Some of the sidewalks were a sheet of ice. Now, I have a bit of a difficult time walking over ice. And so there is an obligation on the part of people to clean their sidewalks and shovel them out and make the streets, make the sidewalks safe and passable. So maybe Martin Walsh and all the mayors across the country will also include that in their pre-storm comments that, you know, there's a responsibility to keep your sidewalks clean. And in fact, not only a moral responsibility, but a legal responsibility, and they will be fined if they don't.
That was Ray Flynn, former mayor of Boston, speaking with Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks in 2015. Also with them in the conversation was the current mayor of Boston, Marty Walsh, and The Atlantic's Yoni Applebaum. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to this special edition of Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're celebrating New England winter this hour. To me, it's always been the most quiet and beautiful of our seasons, the most profoundly introspective. Winter is a chance to step away from the chaos and the din, at least for just a moment. Now, if you feel the same way, I invite you to take a journey with me and cast your mind's eye several miles off the coast of the New Hampshire-Maine border to a place called Star Island.
You would see just a giant expanse of sea and sky. That would be the first thing that would strike you.
This is Alexandra De Steiger. For the past 20 years, she's been Star Island's solo winter caretaker.
The island itself is rather bare. It's very scrubby, a lot of rocks, a lot of big ledges. And then on one portion of the island, there's the big old hotel. So it sort of looms up out of the rock. It has this sense of the past. Most of the buildings are very old, including the hotel. So it feels like you've been dropped not only in place, but in time. It's so quiet. That's the other thing about the island is there's no modern noise. There's no noise of any kind other than the ocean, the surf, and the lighthouse horn. Sometimes the bell buoy ringing when the seas get big. But other than that, it's extremely quiet.
De Steiger winters alone on Star Island. She has an internet connection, if she wants it. She also has her camera. Her ghostly beautiful seascapes and landscapes are collected in the book Small Island, Big Picture, Winters of Solitude, Teach an Artist to See. Alexandra De Steiger is also an accomplished sailor, so she says the splendid, frost-bitten solitude of a Star Island winter was a natural fit.
I was always attracted by the ocean. I wanted to go to sea, even as a young person, so when I was 18, I shipped out on my first ship. It was a tall ship out of Gloucester, Massachusetts, the Regina Maris. And I ended up being a sailor for about, I guess, 9 years on long sea voyages. And then I was visiting a shipmate who was working on Appledore Island, one of the Isles of Shoals. And he said, you know, you should come out, see the Isles of Shoals, they're gorgeous. And I lived in New Hampshire, so I'd never been. And it just so happened that they were looking for a caretaker over on Star Island. And we went over, and I was interviewed, and they hired
me. You were interviewed. What were they looking for in a caretaker?
They were looking for someone who could live remotely and who understood, you know, things about generators and the wind. You know, being a sailor, it was kind of a perfect fit because, you know, I knew how bad storms could be. And I live off the grid in my home. So it was really a good fit.
So you're there all winter long,
yeah.
Off the grid, as you said. What do you do for food, for running water?
There's a cistern under the building that I live in, and so I collect rainwater off the roof. Sometimes I'll run out of water and I have to pump it from the well, which is across the other side of the island, so that could be a bit of a hassle in winter because everything freezes quickly. But for food, my partner Brad visits and he comes and brings food, so I'll email him a big list of groceries and he'll bring it out.
So you have internet?
I do now, yes. When I first moved out 20 years ago, there was some kind of very sketchy radio phone that didn't work very often. You know, no one had cell phones back then. And so, but now, yeah, there's internet. Living the high life out there now.
So you're the only person on the island all winter long.
Yes. Well, I'm the only person on all nine of the islands. There's nine, and they all become deserted.
And how do you... Do you revel in that solitude? I mean, how do you deal with it?
I love solitude. I just it feels like I have this whole wild enclave to myself. And I think as an artist, I get a lot out of solitude because there's a centering that happens when you're alone. You know, when you're with someone, there's always this distraction of, you know, are they enjoying themselves? But when you're alone, there's no one to interact with but yourself. So it's a way to just become quiet and to center on what's around you.
You know, the closest that I've ever had to your experience, it does not hold a candle to being a solo caretaker on a northern Atlantic island, but many years ago, I house sat for a friend for 6 or 7 days, her and her many dogs, and they live out in the country. And I just decided for whatever reason that I... wasn't going to talk. I mean, I could have talked to the dogs, but, you know, they had each other too. Uh-huh. It was so strange. After the first and second day, it was weirdly freeing. Mm. I mean, in that space that was created by the silence from human chatter, mm-hmm. which is funny to say since I make my living talking, but I felt like a kind of soulful liberation that I had never felt before.
Yeah. Yeah, living in the modern world, we take it for granted that, you know, talking is just what we do. But when you don't have to anymore, it is. It's very freeing.
On the other hand, though, I'm curious, you're on an island by yourself. Have there ever been any wild moments that were frightening?
Yeah, the storms out there can be very severe. So there was one year where there was a 91-mile-an-hour storm. And I was there alone, and I stayed inside because with the big old buildings, often the roofing tiles will fly off, and parts of the building will blow away. But even inside, it's scary because the whole house vibrates, and the window glass just bows inward, and you could see it. It almost looks like it's breathing. There was another storm too, where a door on the near the hotel roof had blown in half. It just ripped in half. And so I went up with a piece of plywood. This was after the storm, but it was still quite windy. And I got up there on the roof with this plywood, and I realized that the roof itself was a sheet of ice. It was a flat portion of the hotel roof. And so being a sailor, this was really fun for me. I was able to just angle that plywood, and I sailed myself across that roof. And I set that piece of plywood up against that door, and the wind held it in place, and I was able to screw it there. And
a plywood spinnaker. Like, who would have thought? Right. You've been doing this for 20 years, right?
Or a couple. This will be my 20th winter.
20th yeah. winter. Has the experience changed you?
Yeah. Yeah, it
How?
Has. I feel like I just know myself a lot better. I know what I want in life. I know what's important to my life. And that's the other thing about being alone is you get to figure yourself out.
Now, we have to talk about the fact that you're an artist as well, and you're a photographer, and I've seen some of the pictures that you've taken on the island, and they are so beautiful.
Thank you.
So can you tell me about how looking through the lens of your camera and that way of seeing, what do you see around the island when you're doing that?
Hmm. I guess the way I go about it is when I go out to photograph, I don't think about photographing. What I'll do instead is what's more natural to me, which is to just go out and sit on the rocks and wander about and thoroughly enjoy being there. And then taking pictures is almost an afterthought, you know, of just the sheer enjoyment of the experience. So then making images becomes
a way to participate further with that enjoyment.
Well, I was thinking about the title of your book, right, which is Small Island, Big Picture, Winters of Solitude, Teach an Artist to See.
When I first arrived, you know, everything is new. And when you're in a new place, it's exciting to take pictures of everything because you've not seen anything before. And that's how it was for me. But then after a few years, I realized that, you know, this is a very small place and there's only so many things here to photograph. And I was a little worried that that would become limiting. And then slowly I realized it was not limiting at all because there's always more to see. If you sit quietly in a spot, these subtle things that you never would have noticed start to stand out.
We think we know things. Mm. We think we're familiar with the people and the objects and the landscapes around us because we might see them frequently. But how much do we actually see them?
Yes.
And I think you need time and space and the ability to slow down in order to create an environment where you are really seeing. And then if you're able to do that, they will surprise you.
So for me, it was the more I connected with a place, you know, the more it revealed itself. It made me realize that, you know, even the things we are deeply familiar with, we can even get more from them because there's always more to see.
Yeah. And in your case, when you're spending the winters on Star Island, since you're there alone, there's the elimination of all the possible distractions that might interfere with you seeing things. I mean, that's the thing that I'm almost there and saying, take me with you.
Yeah.
but then there wouldn't be any solitude there. So
right.
So I won't impress myself upon you in that way. Before I let you go, I have to ask you one more question about you and your encounters with rough weather. Because this is the 25th anniversary of The Perfect Storm. And you were caught in that storm.
So I had signed on the Ernestina, which is a ship out of New Bedford. And the trip was to go to the Cape Verde Islands off Africa. So we left Woods Hole and headed out for Bermuda and got, I guess, down to off of Cape Hatteras when Hurricane Grace started coming up the coast. And the seas were huge. And I'd been in storms before, but this one was, you know, I think the biggest that I'd seen. And it was scary. There was one night, especially when the seas were so massive and they were just sweeping the deck. There was a lot of damage to the ship, and we ended up not going to Africa because there's just too much damage. And so we went and we sailed around the Caribbean instead.
Can you tell me what it feels like in the first moments after the weather calms down when you realize you've survived?
As a sailor, you understand that going to sea is a risky thing. So I think the fact that you've signed up for that means that you're the kind of person that type of fear is not going to affect so largely. That's the risk you take. You might die. And so it's not as big a deal as you would think.
Wow. But I get it. It's all about that mindset.
It's perspective.
Yeah.
You know, and when people say, are you scared on the island, you know, when these big storms come? And I said, well, you know, I have a little perspective on that because I'm not scared. I'm on solid rock, you know, and I'm not on a rocking ship that could sink, you know. So everything is perspective.
Even with those Boeing glass windows. So I guess on that note, let me just ask you, you're going out for your 20th winter on Star Island. What's the first thing you're going to do? What's the first thing you usually do?
The first thing I will do, I think, is head out to the rocks on the east side where the ledges are high, and I'll probably stand there and I'll just soak it all in and prepare myself for another long winter alone.
Alexander De Steiger is a photographer and winter caretaker at Star Island. We spoke with her in November 2016, before she left for her 20th winter there. She's on Star Island right now, beginning her 21st winter of blissful solitude. That's our show for today. Stay safe and stay warm. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.